Deuteronomy chapter 21. Let's look at this. Verse 1 of chapter 21 of Deuteronomy. If one be found slain in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee to possess it, lying in the field, and it be not known who hath slain him. So a man has been killed, murdered, and you find this guy laying in a field. Nobody knows who killed him. Nobody knows what happened, really. Then verse 2, the elders and the judges shall come forth, and they shall measure unto the cities which are round about him that is slain. Now, the elders and the judges would be men of maturity, hopefully. That would be the deal here. That would be what's being said. Mature people would come, mature men would come and engage in what just happened. Let me just say this. Mature people do that. When there's trouble in the church, when there's trouble in the body, mature people will engage in it, will deal with it. And that's why we have what are called elders. They're not all elder in age, although some of them are. But elders are guys that are supposed to be mature enough to engage in problems so that you can go to the prayer room and a guy can sit there and say, hey, what's the deal, and pray with you. They're people that will kind of take on issues that need to be taken on. And these guys would have to deal with this. Nobody really would want to do that. I mean, there's a dead guy laying out there in the field. Somebody's got to go out there and figure out what's going on. So the mature elders, judges would go out there and they'd come forth and they would measure the distance between the cities. Remember the cities of refuge. There were cities all around this area in the promised land that was going to be cities of refuge set up where if a man killed somebody inadvertently, like manslaughter, they could run to one of the cities, right? And they were placed strategically so that you wouldn't ever be too far from a city of refuge. So what they're going to do now is they're going to measure to the closest city that this happened next to. And verse 3, it shall come to pass, or it shall be, that the city which is next unto the slain man, even the elders of that city, shall take a heifer which hath not been wrought with, and which hath not drawn in the yoke. And the elders of that city shall bring down the heifer into the rough valley, which is neither eared nor sown, and shall strike off the heifer's neck there in the valley. And the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come near for them the Lord thy God hath chosen to minister unto him, and to bless in the name of the Lord. So the Levites were those chosen by the Lord to come and minister, and by their word shall every controversy and every stroke be tried. And verse 6, all the elders of that city that are next unto the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer that is beheaded in the valley, and they shall answer and say, our hands have not shed this blood, neither have our eyes seen it. Be merciful, O Lord, unto thy people Israel, whom thou hast redeemed, and lay not innocent blood unto thy people of Israel's charge, and the blood shall be forgiven them. So shalt thou put away the guilt of innocent blood from among you, when thou shalt do that which is right in the sight of the Lord. So the mature elders will deal with this issue by measuring the closest city of refuge. Then they will go to that city and meet with the elders of the city. And then those elders of the city then will have to take responsibility for what happened there, even though it didn't happen in their city, it happened nearest to their city. It's kind of like in our county, you know. We would have to take responsibility. Someone's going to have to deal with something that happens in our county. So these elders would have to deal with that that took place close by. And not knowing who committed the crime meant that something had to take place to make it right. And that's what's going on here. They take this heifer and they take it out into this valley that's never been tilled, that's never had anything done to it as far as growing, you know, vegetables or corn or anything like that. And they take this heifer, which has never worked a day in its life. It's never been yoked, it says. It's never been hooked up to the yoke. It's never worked. It's a ox or a heifer that's never been worked a day in its life. What's being said here? It's kind of interesting. The ground couldn't be worked, and neither could the animal that was sacrificed. Of course, we may jump to the thought in our thinking about no works. It's grace that covers our sin. It's grace, it's mercy. It's not something that we work for to attain, but it's simply grace. And it speaks of Jesus, of course, and it's interesting because the priests would be there, the leaders, the elders would be there, but they wouldn't be the ones that cut off the head of that animal. It was just the councilmen, if you would, of the city of refuge. It was laymen that did this. Laymen cut off the head of the animal, while the officials, so to speak, the priests, so to speak, watched. Now, does that ring any bells in your thinking? The sacrifice that was made here for this sin that was done in this area, in this township, so to speak, in this county, the men of that city had to deal with that issue by cutting off the head. And of course, when Jesus Christ was crucified, the Jewish leaders, the priests, wouldn't get themselves really involved in the process of crucifixion. They had laymen do it. They had the Romans do it for them as they watched. And this pictures that kind of amazingly. And what did Pilate do when he spoke to Jesus in that confrontation he had with Jesus? He said, hey, this guy's innocent. This man has done nothing, and I'm washing my hands. What does it say here? They would wash their hands over the heifer, verse 6, that was beheaded in the valley. And then what would happen? And then they would cry out, "Be merciful, O Lord, unto thy people Israel, whom thou hast redeemed, and lay not innocent blood unto thy people of Israel's charge." Do not charge this to the account of Israel. What is it that Jesus said? "Father, forgive them. They know not what they're doing." Don't put this on their account. Don't charge them with this, you see. And again, another wonderful picture of Jesus Christ, but he prays here. These priests pray here for the nation, just like Jesus prayed for the Father to forgive the nation, the people that put him to death. Now, it's interesting to me because our nation, folks, it's a mess. You know, and with elections coming up, it doesn't really matter. Let me tell you that. And we talked about this before, it doesn't matter who's president or who's senator or who. This nation's a mess. And what needs to happen is what's happening here, and the nation needs to cry out and say, "Be merciful unto us, Lord. We're sinners. We're wicked. We're evil, and we need forgiveness." And here, you see, it's being said that there's been a problem and there's a crime and there's things that are going on that are wrong. But the right thing is done, and that's why the blood was covered that was shed that day. Not that the man that committed the crime was forgiven, but the nation wasn't held responsible for it. Because when blood was shed in the land, it defiled the land and it needed to be cleansed. Whenever there's sin, and guys, don't forget this, even if somebody sins and nobody knows who did it, the whole land, the whole group, the whole church, so to speak, gets defiled. And my sin, your sin, affects the whole body. A little leaven, remember, works its way into the whole lump. And we're all lumps. And every time one of us little lumps sins, the whole lump is affected. And that's true. It's true then, it's true now, and we need the same type of action. And I hope even more than getting involved politically, I hope you pray for our nation. Just pray. Pray for the forgiveness of our nation. We are sick. and we need forgiveness as a nation. Well, we do individually too, but as a country, we're just not what we ought to be. So that's how they put away the innocent blood that wouldn't affect the whole nation by giving the sacrifice, you see, that was acceptable. Now, verse 10, when thou goest forth to war against thine enemies, and the Lord thy God hath delivered them into thine hands, note that, it's when, not if, and thou hast taken them captive, and seest among the captives a beautiful woman, and hast a desire unto her, and that thou wouldest have her to thy wife, then thou shalt bring her home to thine house, and she shall shave her head and pare her nails, and she shall put the raiment of her captivity from off her. So, as they were dealing with these other peoples around them that they were at war with and basically taking them over, and when the Lord delivered them into their hands, if one of the men saw one of the women in that particular town or in that particular group of people that they were fighting against, and she was attractive to the man could take her home, but he couldn't do anything with her initially. He had to bring her into his home, and then she, the woman, would have to agree to this, but she'd have to shave her head. Now, it's an interesting thing to make her do. Now, we understand, though, that this is a woman that came from a pagan group of people. These were heathens. So she would have to be willing to basically convert, right? Become a Jew. And so what this pictures is kind of interesting, because shaving the head was the same thing a leper had to do for their cleansing. And you know what leprosy represents, right? Sin. So it's interesting, because in this picture, you see the husband, this husband-to-be, wants this wife, so he brings her home, but she's got to shave her head, become bald, and pare her nails, which means to grow her nails. Now, back then, growing your nails was not attractive. It was bizarre. So things change, don't they? You women spend bucks on doing your nails. And back then, they would have thought, brother, what are you doing? They would grow their nails out and shave their heads, though, these women that would be brought in by these Israelite men that wanted to have them as wives. Now, were these Canaanite women? No. They weren't to touch the Canaanite women, remember? They weren't to touch the Moabite women. There were certain groups in that promised land region that God says, no, 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 you don't mix with them at all. But the nations that were farther out, those people that were out around the region, they could if they wanted to, but this was the process. So what would happen is if the guy says, hey, I want this woman to be my wife, well, the Lord says, great, you can do that. Bring her home and shave her head. Now, do you still want her? And if the man said, boom, I didn't realize the shape of her head was that way, but yeah, I think I still want her. You know, I think I still want, yeah, she's still okay. It'll grow back. And the nails growing, the nails would be kind of a disgusting thing. So here's the deal. This man was to watch this beautiful woman that he's so attracted to shave her head and start growing her nails. And for a month, it says here, for a month, verse 13 goes on, he shall remain in the house and bewail her father and mother a full month. So, I want to marry this woman. Okay. She's going to shave her head, grow her nails, and she's going to wail and moan for a month. Do you still want her? You know, this is the idea here. And so if the man did still want her, you see, then he would then be able to take her, go in under her and become her husband, and she would become his wife. It's an interesting thing, isn't it? This man would have to really, really want to marry her. It wouldn't be just like they could just take over a place or a town or a group of people and then just pillage the women. Not by God's standard, you see. When that went on, it wasn't what God wanted. He wanted, if you're going to be with a woman, you bring her home and do it right. And you let her mourn, and you let her shave her head and convert and become one of you, you see. And if you want her, then you will allow that to be. And notice she had to put the raiment of her captivity off of her. The old clothes had to go. He had to put on new clothes. And the picture is pretty plain, isn't it? It's the same thing that Jesus did for us. Our bridegroom, he's brought us in, but we had to do what? Shave our heads. Like a leper being cleansed. We had to basically allow for that process of moaning and groaning to take place. Many of us are still doing that. We've been saved, we've been converted, but it's been long, long past a month that we've been moaning and groaning about our conversion, if you would. Oh boy, it's tough being a Christian, people say. Oh man. And some people even say, boy, it was better back then, you know, when I was an unbeliever. I just kind of did my thing and, you know, moaning and groaning. But the woman was to put on new clothes. And we, as you know, are clothed in a different clothing now. As we're born again, we put on the robe of righteousness that belongs to Jesus Christ. So the new clothes had to be put on and all the rest. The picture is pretty cool. But anyway, let's move on. And it shall be if thou have no delight in her. Now, verse 14 says, the man shaves her head and she grows her nails and she wails and moans for a month. And he really just can't take it. You know, her head's just shaped a little too funny. The nail thing's bugging me. And she's wailing and moaning all the time. I'm done. I changed my mind. It's not going to work. And so if that's the case, they shall let her go, whether she will. In other words, just let her go. But thou shalt not sell her at all for money. Thou shalt not make merchandise of her, because thou hast humbled her. Well, I guess so. Shaved her head and, you know, made her. I mean, if he didn't like her, even after all that, the idea here is that he's just to let her go. Not to sell her, not to make money on her, not to make merchandise of her. He's humbled her. She's to just go free. This really protected the women back there from the nation Israel going in and pillaging like other nations would do. It really did protect the women. If a man have two wives, one beloved and another hated, and they have borne him children, both the beloved and the hated, and if the firstborn son be hers that was hated, then it shall be when he maketh his sons to inherit that which he hath, that he may not make the son of the beloved firstborn before the son of the hated, which is indeed the firstborn. So people read this and they go, was God into marrying more than one wife? No, but they were, and they did. And just because they did, God says, hey, listen, you're doing this, and this is a rule that you cannot break. And that is this: you marry one wife, and then you decide you don't like her that much. And so you marry another wife, and you take the wife of the second marriage, so to speak, the second wife, and you like her better. She's more loved by you. So her kids and your kids are going to be more important to you than your first wife and those kids? Uh-uh. You can't forget about your first children because you're married to another person or you have a second wife. Who would have understood this reality? Jacob. Remember Jacob? And he married his lovely wife, remember, after he married his not-so-lovely wife, Leah. Remember, it was to be Leah and Rachel, and he worked all those years to get Rachel, and Laban tricked him, and he had to work 7 more years. So he ended up with 2 wives, 2 for the price of 1, Leah and Rachel. But as we understand, the scripture says, Leah was one who made your eyes hurt, literally. So she wasn't real attractive. And, you know, Jacob had children with her, and Rachel couldn't have kids for a long time, remember? And it was kind of a tough deal. But here's the interesting thing to me. God says, I want you to make sure that you keep that firstborn in place. But here's what's interesting to me. God switched them. He not only switched Jacob and his brother Esau and allowed Jacob to be the firstborn in a sense, but he did that to Ishmael and Isaac, didn't he? He did it with Cain and Abel. He's done that so many times, we start wondering, well, whoa, wait, Lord, you just said here that you can't do that. Well, we can't do that, but he can. And what does it mean? Well, I think the spiritual implication is pretty amazing. The firstborn pictures that one born in the flesh. And all throughout the stories, you read it again and again, that God would not accept that firstborn. He accepted the second one. The second born, not the one born first or born in the flesh, but the second born, the one who was born again. In other words, the fleshly birth that we all experienced isn't the thing that God accepts. It's not that that makes it possible for you to be with God. It's the second birth. So God could switch them, and he did. And the picture is really awesome. But as far as how we deal with our kids, how a man would deal with his kids. And today, this is extremely pertinent, I think, because of how many marriages are broken up in a second wife and a third wife and a fourth wife and a fifth wife and a sixth wife and a seventh. I mean, wow. It goes on and on, right? And how often does this happen where there's a couple of marriages in the mix and the first child, because the man hates the wife now, that the children feel the brunt of that, and the inheritance has changed and all the rest. It shouldn't happen. Shouldn't be. God says, no, don't do it. You shall acknowledge, verse 17, the son of the hated for the firstborn by giving him a double portion, all that he hath, for he is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. Protecting that particular reality, which I think is amazingly important today. Now, if a man have a stubborn, rebellious son, which will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and that when they have chastened him, tried to discipline him, will not hearken unto them, then shall his father and his mother lay hold of him and bring him out unto the elders of the city and unto the gate of his place. And they shall say unto the elders of this city, this is our son. He is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. And all the men of his city shall stone him with stones that he die. Well, that was some incentive to behave yourself. If you were a kid back then, don't you think? Like, okay, son, do you think you want to take the trash out? You betcha, Dad. Now, this is really heavy. Don't you think? Wow. All the men are going to take him out and stone him right there. So shall you put evil away from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. Boy. Now, this is the law, folks. This was how the law was to be played out. If a son wouldn't listen to his parents and was rebellious, stubborn, a drunkard, a glutton, just, you know, a party animal, we would say. And without any patience for his parents, never wants to talk to his parents, never wants to do anything for his parents, just wants to run over him and all the rest. Well, he was to be taken out and put to death. Huh. Now, this contrasts another son in the scriptures that Jesus spoke of in Luke chapter 15. Because Jesus told the story of a son who was rebellious, who wouldn't do what his father wanted, and who ran off and did what? Got drunk. He was a glutton and a drunk, and he spent all his money on wine, women, and song, and then found himself in a pig pen with the pigs. Right? And what happened in that story is such an amazing contrast to what happens here. Because this is the law, folks, but Jesus came and said, but when the prodigal son, who had gone off and spent his father's money and wasted it on drinking and partying, when he came back, the father saw him while he was a great distance off. Now, this might shed some new light on this story for you. We understand that it wasn't normal for a father, an old man, to run, period. Jewish men didn't run. They weren't in a hurry for anything. But in this story, the father's running to his son, right? Why is that? Well, we always say, hey, that's the picture of God the Father. As we come back as prodigal sons and daughters, hey, he runs to us because he can't wait to get to us to love on us, right? But that's not all that's happening here. The father sees the son a far distance from his house. He knows the men in the gate, the men that are there on the city outskirts are going to see that son, knowing what that son's been doing. The whole area's heard about his gallivanting all around the countryside, getting drunk, being disrespectful to his parents. The father runs out there to protect his son, embraces him. Because those men then would have to throw rocks at the father. But how could they when the father's embracing him, putting the ring on his finger and the robe around him and loving on him and hugging him and kissing his neck, the men would have to just back off. That's the difference between the law and grace and mercy. You see, God ran to our defense, rather than letting the law and those that would have to exercise the justice of the law, let them destroy us. Because we've all been that son. We've all been that prodigal. We've all been that one. What an amazing difference, you see. The law was brutal. But grace and mercy is awesome. Sweet. The father was loving him, you see. And this kind of hit me, too. I mean, you know, we've all experienced the reality of wayward kids. I experienced it in myself. I was a wayward kid. Boy, was I wayward. You know, and I would have been stoned. Well, I was stoned. But I would have been stoned a lot more than this guy was. I mean, they would have, if this was lived out, I would have been taken out of the city in stone more than once. Of course, I would have been dead the first time, so they would have been kind of redundant in their. But I was awful, and I experienced that in myself, and I'm blessed my children aren't the way I was. But you know what's interesting to me is that oftentimes we as parents don't realize the importance of raising our kids in Christ, letting them know who Jesus is at a very young age, because there is a reality here that's kind of interesting. Deal with your kids, if you've got young ones, deal with them now so they don't get stoned later. Because this is the reality that is being pictured in a sense. This young rebellious guy, you know, was too far gone, according to the story. He was just out there and wouldn't come back, and he was just, you know, and so he got stoned. And sometimes that's the way it is. And it's not that every time a parent raises a child and does so even in the ways of the Lord, that that child's going to be a perfect little angel. But the Bible says, raise up a child. Raise up a child in the ways of God. Raise him up, and he will not depart from those things. Oh, he might for a season, but he'll come back. He'll return, you see, unto you and unto the Lord. So don't fret if your child's not getting it, you think, or they're not understanding. Keep pumping it in. Keep filling them up with spiritual food, because it will make a difference in their life. So the idea, though, was putting evil away from them, verse 21 says. And verse 22, if a man have committed a sin worthy of death, and he be put to death, and thou hang him on the tree, his body shall not remain all night upon the tree, but thou shalt in any wise bury him that day, for he that is hanged is accursed of God, and thy land be not defiled, which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance. So, they didn't hang people in Jewish custom. They didn't hang people to kill them. They stoned people to death. What's being said here, if a man was committed a crime, if he's done something really evil, they would stone him to death, then they would hang him on a tree. They used to hang people on trees or on walls or whatever if they wanted everybody to see that that person had done something rotten, and a warning really to anybody else. You see, this is what happens to real bad criminals. And so they stone him to death, and he's already dead, so the guy doesn't care anymore. But it warns people that, hey, look, there he is. He's hanging there. You see. Now, amazingly, Paul, the Apostle Paul, picks up on this same verse in Galatians 3:13 when he says that cursed is every man that hangs on a tree. And if you read that, you don't have to turn there. I can read it to you if you want. But what Paul says there is kind of enlightening, considering it's being said back here. But in Galatians chapter 3, verse 13, Christ hath redeemed us, Paul says, from the curse of the law, being made a curse for us, for it is written, cursed is everyone that hangeth on a tree. So using that same quotation from back here in Deuteronomy chapter 21, Paul says, hey, Christ was this one that's being spoken of here. He was the one cursed and hung on a tree. For cursed is everyone that hangs on a tree. And Christ bore that particular curse for us, right? He's the one that redeemed us, Paul says, from the curse. How? By becoming the curse. He became sin to pay for my sin. He actually took that upon himself so I could be relieved of it. It's like someone transferring the weight. If you've got a bunch of weight and you are carrying it around, and you can hand that off to somebody and they take it and you're relieved of it, you feel a lot lighter, but he feels a lot heavier. He became that curse, and cursed he was for me. Cursed he was for you, you see. Paul says this is the picture that's being painted here. His body shall not remain. And what did they do with Jesus' body? Did they let it remain? No, but they were going to. They were going to let it remain. Why didn't they let the body of Jesus hang there? Do you remember? Because the next day was a holy Sabbath. And they had all kinds of activities and programs set up for the next day. And they went to the authorities. They went to Pilate and they went to the authorities and said, could you please take him down from there? Because he's interfering with everything. He's interfering with our day tomorrow. We can't have a dead body hanging around while we go through our traditions. Amazing. They wouldn't want Jesus hanging there because he was interfering with their traditions. I wonder how many Christians, how many churches would be guilty of that. Get him out of here. He's interfering. That's what the Jews said. That's what the Pharisees said. He's interfering with what we're doing. Get him out. Take him down. Move him away. Take him down from there. It's embarrassing to us. Cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. He was cursed for me and for you. Now, thou shalt, verse 1, not see thy brother's ox or his sheep go astray and hide thyself from them. This is a great word. Thou shalt in any case bring them again unto thy brother. And if thy brother be not nigh unto thee, or if thou shalt know him not, then thou shalt bring it unto thine house, and it shall be with thee until thy brother seek after it, and thou shalt restore it to him again. So if you find something of your neighbor's, you know, an ox or a sheep or something or a hammer or a ladder, you know, or something like that, you take it back to him. Now, of course, an animal can walk. Ladders and hammers don't generally, unless they're attached to something. Then they walk away. But the point is if you find something, give it back. You know, and if you don't know whose it belongs to or whatever, well, hang on to it. And maybe one of your neighbors will be asking around, hey, you see my ladder? Looks just like that one in your backyard. No. give it back, you know, restore it unto him again. Be a good neighbor. God had a good neighbor policy in place. Don't be a bum for a neighbor. You know, be a good neighbor. Help your neighbor out. If he's looking for his stuff and you know where it's at, don't bury your head in the sand like it says. Or don't hide from him. Oh, here comes Joe, you know, hiding him around the back of the garage because you don't want him to see it. You ever seen that happen? I've seen that literally happen in neighborhoods where someone's kind of unloading something heavy and, you know, all the neighbors kind of duck their heads behind their curtains, you know, like, uh-oh. If he sees me, you know, he's going to ask me to help. And we've adopted that, oh, boy, I'd like to help you, Jim, but got a bad back, you know. Don't be a bad neighbor, he says. And in like manner shalt thou do with his ass, and so shalt thou do with his raiment, and with all the lost things of thy brothers, which he hath lost, and thou hast found. Thou shalt do likewise. Thou mayest not hide thyself. Don't be hiding from him when you know you've got his stuff. Thou shalt not see thy brother's ass or his ox fall down by the way and hide thyself from them. Thou shalt surely help him to lift them up again. So your neighbor has his animals and they're falling in a ditch and all that, and he's trying to pull them out, you know, and you walk by and go, boy, that looks tough, and you keep walking. Instead of stopping and helping him out, you know, that's not the right thing to do. And so the neighborly thing, and you all know what this is, the neighborly thing to do is to be helpers of people's joy. Try and help people out. Try and make their life easier. Don't hide from them. Don't try and skirt it. You see, don't try and get her out of the job that's being done. I mean, when someone's needy, help them. Jesus would say this, if you can help somebody and you don't, you're guilty of doing them damage. If you could stop somebody from being hurt, we would say, obviously, you were negligent. You should have stopped that. You know, in other words, if you saw a car coming down the street and there's somebody standing in the middle of the street and they don't see the car and you don't go, hey, get out of there, then, you know, you're negligent for seeing them get hurt. And you're responsible, according to what Jesus said. If you're not helping, you're hurting. And I don't like that particular truth, frankly. I don't like that black and white type of stuff that Jesus says all the time. You're either, you know, he says you're either gathering or you're scattering. And I want to think, no, I'm just sitting. I'm not doing anything. And Jesus won't let me do that. He won't let me have that attitude. He won't let me have the attitude that I can just be complacent and not help anybody. I can just sit there and I'm not doing anything wrong. And Jesus says, yes, you are. You're doing something. If you can help and you're not, you're hurting. Tough being a Christian, people say. Now, all of a sudden, out of the blue, Moses just kind of jumps gears here and just like derails the whole subject matter. He's talking about good neighbors and helping people out. And all of a sudden he says, the woman shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a man. Neither shall a man put on a woman's garment. Speaking of your neighbors, listen. Some of you might have neighbors like this. But the... You don't wear women's clothes, guys. Just don't do it. As tempting as it might be, just don't put them on, you know? Now, the interesting thing here is that the woman is told that she shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a man, which has a whole different connotation than a man who actually puts on a woman's garment. Two different things are addressed here. The woman is not to take on that which pertains to men, whereas the man is not to wear women's clothes. And this might tie into what Paul says there to Timothy in 1 Timothy 2:12, where he says, I don't allow the woman to usurp authority over the men. She's not to take on the man's role. And I think this is interesting because, you know, I think that it's a little bit more risque, in my opinion, to see a man in women's clothing than a woman in men's clothing. You know, a woman wears Levi's, I don't think anything of it. A man wears a skirt, I've got a problem with that. You know, it just hits me different. I don't know, but call me silly, but I think it's a little bit different to have a guy wearing a dress. And it's interesting because the woman does have that particular instruction given throughout the word that she's not to take on the man's authority, to take on that which pertains to a man. And I think that even back then, isn't it amazing, there was cross-dressing going on. I mean, what did they wear? They already wore robes, didn't they? I mean, what is she, you know, what's a man going to put on of a woman's? I hasten to think about it. But whatever, either way, for all that do so are an abomination unto the Lord thy God. Wearing that which doesn't belong to you. In other words, God's saying there's a distinction between men and women. Don't cloud it. Don't mix it up. Don't confuse it. Don't make it difficult to try and figure out. You know, I remember hearing a story that J. Vernon McGee told. He said he was driving down in Pasadena, California, where he lived. And of course, this was back in the 70s when he wrote it, probably. And shared this story, but he was saying how he was driving down the street and there was a 1965 Volkswagen van, you know, with flower power written all over it and all that stuff. And he's talking to his wife and he was sharing how this woman was driving the van and the man was sitting, you know, in the passenger seat, you know, and they were just kind of talking and drove up beside the van and looked over and no. It was the man driving and the woman sitting in the passenger seat. But from behind, you thought it was the other way around. You see, the man had the long hair down to here and the woman had this crop cut, you know. And it was just kind of humorous to him, you know. In a sense, he went, I don't know that I like that, he said. I think a woman should look like a woman and a man should look like a man. And that's what God's saying here. There's a distinction. Don't confuse it. Don't mess around with it. If you're a man, look like a man. If you're a woman, look like a woman. I prefer it that way, personally. Why is this so, though? It breeds confusion. This is the issue. And God is not the author of confusion. It's confusing, folks. And we are in a confused world. My goodness, are we ever confused. Confounded. And just, it's a, you know, we are living in kind of the epitome of what happens when this isn't really held to. And again, we're not just talking about styles of clothing. We're talking about women's clothes on men. You know, it just doesn't wash, or it should be washed or something. Anyway, verse 6, if a bird's nest chance to be for thee in the way, in any tree or on the ground, whether they be young ones or eggs, and the dame sitting upon the young or upon the eggs, that thou shalt not take the dame with the young. So if you found a bird's nest on the ground or whatever, and there's eggs in it, and there's the little mother bird, you know, sitting on the eggs or whatever. Well, you're not to take the bird and the eggs. You're not to say, okay, I've got fried bird and eggs for breakfast. Nice. It's, you can have fried eggs, but you can't take the mother bird. In a sense, God protects even nature in his law. It's kind of interesting that he would say that. He cares even for birds. Jesus said, hey, there's not even one sparrow that falls from heaven that your Father doesn't know about. Which should give us, by the way, just some extra insight into God's care for us. Because Jesus said, of course, you are worth many sparrows. And if your Father knows each one that falls, then you can rest assured that he cares for you. But thou shalt in any wise let the dame go, verse 7, that the young can be taken to thee, that it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest prolong thy days. When thou buildest a new house, verse 8, again changes gears here, then thou shalt make a battlement for thy roof, that thou bring not blood upon thine house, if any man fall from thence. Now, what he's saying here is that when you build a house and you've got your roof, you need to build a railing around it. Now, we don't build railings around our roofs, but back then their roofs were flat. And they had stairs going up to them, and they would sit up there like a deck. That was their deck or their patio in those days. Remember when Peter was there at Simon the Tanner's house, and he was there on the roof. You know, he didn't climb up on the roof and sit, you know, sit up on the, you know, the roof of the house. It was the deck. It was the patio. And they would lounge there in the cool of the day. So when you build that, though, God said, build a rail around that deck so that if someone comes over, they don't fall off. Or the kids, maybe, that you have won't fall off. So he says, protect your home. But I think that there's something else there as far as building a rail around your house. Do you have your house protected? Are you protecting your home from what's going on out there? Is it safe? Is your home safe? It ought to be. Your home ought to be a place where you and your family and your kids can come and they're not going to fall. Sadly, that's not the case so often. So often kids go home and that's exactly what happens. They fall. They get hurt because the home isn't a safe place. And take note of that. You know, you have that ability and control in your home to make it a place where your family and your kids are safe. Safe from influences and junk. There's a lot of stuff out in the world. I remember one time when my son Daniel came home. He was in high school at the time, and he came home, and he was on the football team, and so, you know, he heard his share of language and junk, and it used to wear on him pretty badly, you know, and this one evening he came home, you know, and we were sitting there in the living room, and he came in and shut the door and just kind of sighed, and he just said, I love our home. And it just felt safe to him, and a place where, you know, he wasn't going to hear somebody say, well, you blankety blank, 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 you know. And that's what a home should be, folks. It should be safe. Put a rail around it if you have to. Protect those that are in your home. And thou shalt not sow thy vineyard with divers seeds, lest the fruit of thy seed which thou hast sown and the fruit of thy vineyard be defiled. Thou shalt not plow with an ox and an ass together. Thou shalt not wear a garment of diverse sorts, as of woolen and linen together. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. No mixture. In your life, don't be mixing seeds together. Don't be mixing up, you see, the way that you plow with an ox and a donkey. Don't mix your clothing. And it all speaks of compromise and mixing things up. It means don't be unequally yoked with an unbeliever. It means don't get yourself involved with worldly things that are going to cause there to be compromise in your life. It's really that simple. But it's interesting because he uses wool and linen together as a garment not to wear together. And of course, we understand that the priests wore linen when they served. It was cool. They weren't to wear any wool that was hot and sweaty. And we all understand that when we serve, it's not to be sweaty and hot. It's to be cool. But when you mix wool and linen together, you know what happens when you wash that garment? If it's got wool and linen sewn together, you know what happens? The wool shrinks. The linen doesn't. One of the garment parts shrink. This is what happens, I believe, in a marriage, for example, that's unequally yoked together. Somebody shrinks. Somebody shrinks back. Generally speaking, it can be the Christian that shrinks back, gets pulled back. And that's why the warning. And Paul, of course, makes that clear as well, you know, when he says that in 1 Corinthians. Don't do that. Don't be unequally yoked, you know. And why? Well, when you mix that garment of wool and linen, it shrinks and it tears, the fabric tears apart at that point, which happens often. And thou shalt make the fringes upon thy four quarters of thy vesture, wherewith thou coverest thyself. The fringes reminded the people of their covenant with God. And if any man take a wife and go in unto her and hate her and give occasions of speech against her and bring up an evil name upon her and say, I took this woman and I came in unto her and found her not a maid. So this is the indication of a man who marries a woman and then says, he doesn't like her, doesn't want her, and starts bringing an evil report about her that she was not a virgin when he married her. So the reality is he doesn't want her, and therefore he's making this up. It shall be then, verse 15, that the father of the damsel and her mother take and bring forth the tokens of the damsel's virginity unto the elders of the city in the gate. And the damsel's father shall say unto the elders, I gave my daughter unto this man to wife, and he hateth her. And lo, he hath given occasion of speech against her, saying, I have found not thy daughter a maid. And yet these are the tokens of my daughter's virginity, and they shall spread the cloth before the elders of the city. This would be majorly embarrassing for the woman, I would think. Back then, though, this had to be done occasionally, and some fathers, after the marriage was consummated between their daughter and the man, he would actually hang the sheet out the window, proving that his daughter was actually a virgin when she was married. Boy, you can be thankful we don't live in that day and age. But the man would be, listen, the man who tried that would be brought to task because they could prove, of course, that she was. And if that was the case, you see, then the elders of that city, verse 18, shall take that man and chastise him, and they shall immerse him in 100 shekels of silver and give them unto the father of the damsel, because he hath brought up an evil name upon a virgin of Israel. And she shall be his wife, and he may not put her away all of his days. He cannot divorce her. Now, I don't know if I'd be wanting to stay with this guy after that. But this was the way that the law read. And he would be charged 100 shekels of silver, a fair chunk of change back then, a lot of money. and that would be given to the father of the bride. You know, it's still not real clear as what the bride gets out of this. you know, she gets stuck with this bozo, and her dad gets some bucks. You know, it doesn't seem quite fair, but her name was cleared. Her name was cleared in this process. But watch this now. If verse 20, this thing be true, and the tokens of her virginity be not found for the damsel, then they shall bring out the damsel to the door of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her with stones that she die. Boy, there's just not any good way to go for this gal, you know? And because she hath wrought folly in Israel to play the whore in her father's house, so shalt thou put evil away from among you. So if the woman, if the girl was not a virgin, it was proved that that was true, then she was to be stoned to death. Again, don't forget what we're speaking of here. This is the law being spoken of. It was brutal. It was unforgiving. It was lacking mercy. And why do we have to know what the law said? What did Paul say about the law? The law was given to us as a schoolmaster, right? It instructed us in something that would cause us to go, oh man, this is terrible, this is brutal. And it would drive us, it would force us, it would push us, where? To Christ, to Jesus, where there'd be mercy and grace. Yeah, it seems brutal, but it's interesting because this bride, in a sense, pictures what Israel did end up doing. The problem that Israel had so often was idolatry, and God called it being a whore. He said that Israel has gone a-whoring. They've taken after other gods, which was committing spiritual adultery against God. And so, in a sense, the picture is clear, and that's what would happen with Israel. There would be death. There would be enslavement and bondage because of that. And it's true. The wages of sin is death. Now, why did she have to be stoned on her father's porch, so to speak? Because he was responsible. He was responsible to deliver a virgin. And so, in his household, something took place where her virginity was lost. You see, dad wasn't keeping a real close eye on his daughter. And so he was responsible for it. Sadly, whenever he would come out of his front door, he would be reminded of that. And part of these things, guys, remember, God was saying, put the evil away from you. And this would cause there to be a real stir in the community, don't you think? You know, a son is rebellious and kind of out of line, and they take that son out and stone him to death. Well, those fathers that were there standing by watching that, don't you think they might have gone home and said, I got to really get right with Billy here and make sure he's walking right? Don't you think? If one virgin, so to speak, that didn't turn out to be a virgin was stoned to death, how many fathers would go home and say, honey, now make sure, don't allow, you know, these young Israeli boys around here, you know, to get too close now. I mean, it would stir them up, and that would be the intent, but you cannot escape the brutality of the law. Don't try and resolve this and say, boy, you know, is that what we're under? Is this what God's going to do to me if I'm not clean and I'm not pure? No, there's a whole new covenant, you see. But if a man be found, continues on, lying with a woman married to a husband, then they shall both of them die, both the man and the woman that lay with the woman, and the woman, so shalt thou put evil away from Israel. Now, if a damsel that is a virgin be betrothed unto a husband, and a man find her in the city and lie with her, then you shall bring them both out of the gate of the city, and you shall stone them with stones that they die. Now, this is interesting. There in John chapter 8, Jesus was brought a woman caught in adultery. Remember? And they brought her out, and the Jewish leaders stood there and said, this woman's been caught in adultery, and she should be stoned. What do you say? And it was a trap, of course. They were trying to trap Jesus. And Jesus didn't say anything to them. He stooped down and began to write in the dirt. We don't know what he was writing, but he was writing something in the dirt. And those men were kind of looking at what he was writing. And then he stooped down again and started writing some more. And again, we don't have any idea what he was writing, but whatever it was caused these men to take another look at this thing. Because Jesus stood up and said, well, if you don't have any sin in your life, then you start throwing stones. And one by one they left. What did he write? I don't know. Who knows what he wrote down there? Could be, you know, names or times or whatever. The amazing thing was, is that what did the law say? Then, verse 24, you shall bring them both out unto the gate in the city and stone them with stones. Where was the man? Where was the man that was caught in adultery with this woman? The law said, bring them both out. These lawgivers, these lawmakers, these law enforcers only brought the woman out. Why? Because it was a trap. And the man was probably someone they knew. And so they didn't bring him out. And Jesus said, you're out of line. And you're just as bad, if not worse. So if you want to start throwing rocks, you better be clean. And I think that's a good word, don't you think? If you want to throw rocks, feel free, as long as you're clean. If you can stand up and say, I'm clean, no sin here, then, you know, heave away. But I think Jesus would write something in the sand, in the dirt, about you. And verse 25, if a man find a betrothed damsel in the field, and the man force her and lie with her, then the man only that lay with her shall die. Obviously, rape. The man is brought to justice. The damsel, they shall do nothing unto her. There is in the damsel no sin worthy of death, obviously. And for as when a man riseth against his neighbor and slayeth him, even so is this matter. God compares rape to murder. Personally, I agree with this particular indictment. Someone who rapes is the same as a murderer because he's stolen something of a life from that woman. And they would put him to death. And he found her in the field and the betrothed damsel cried, and there was none to save her. Because of that, you see. But, he says, if a man find a damsel that is a virgin, which is not betrothed, and lay hold on her and lie with her, and they be found, then the man that lay with her shall give unto the damsel's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife. So if a man just happens upon a woman out there, and they kind of have some hanky-panky going on, and it's found out, then it wasn't forced. She had something to do with it. Then he has to marry her. Would this be incentive to stay away from young girls for young men? If you sleep with her, she's your wife. I've told my boys that when they were younger. Don't mess around with girls in that way, because if you marry her, it's because you've had sex with her, and that's the rule. That's what God says. She's your wife. If you've had sexual relations with her, then you're married. And, of course, young men these days, well, I don't want to get married. I don't want to marry anybody. Well, you should have thought of that before. You see, you did it. I think it would be a healthy incentive. I really do. Because this man that was found just kind of messing around, playing around. He didn't have any desire to get married, but when it was found out, he not only had to pay, but he had to make her his wife, because he hath humbled her. He may not put her away all his days. Cost him. It cost him. It cost him. And he was responsible to take care, to make sure that that woman was taken care of. In other words, there was none of this one-night stand stuff. And then the woman's just kind of left there, you see. And a man shall not take his father's wife, nor discover his father's skirt. 1 Corinthians 5 talks about a man who had his father's wife, his stepmom. And Paul says, you're kind of proud that you've accepted that. Paul says, you need to get rid of that man. You need to cast him out of your church, out of your fellowship, until he understands that what he's done is wrong. And if he repents, then you can restore him again. It was wrong. And they were proud of it. And God said all the way back there in Deuteronomy, this was not to be. You see. And this was not even what we would call true incest. It was a relationship that was not of blood, but it was just as wicked, because a man's wife, no matter whether the stepson or the stepdaughter or whatever the situation might be, they were still family. Once a family comes together, it's family. So heavy subject matter, huh? But isn't it amazing that man hasn't changed a whole lot? In all the thousands of years that man has been on this earth, his character and the things that he has involved himself with have not changed a whole bunch. If those people were believers, then they went to paradise. God took them out. And I still believe God takes people out oftentimes. When a believer simply is heading the wrong direction, I don't think God hesitates sometimes to say, I got to take you home. Otherwise, you're going to spread some infection. I had a business partner that I believe the Lord did that to years ago, back in the Rogue Valley, that he just was going so far the other way. And one day, I got back from a camping trip. In fact, it was a family camp of Applegate's. I got back from family camp on a Sunday afternoon, had a phone message, and called this person and said, I read this in the paper, and I think this is your partner. And sure enough, and it was the weirdest thing. He went water skiing and pulled a muscle in his arm, and before 12 hours were up, he had this toxic shock, weird thing that killed him, just like that. And I'd been praying and praying and praying for him, and Lord, do something. And then I went, oh, whoa, wait a minute. Wow. And people might think, boy, that's terrible. Not as terrible as the things he was doing. Not as bad as what he was spreading, in the infection that he was causing to spread. And I believe he's in heaven. But I believe he's one that made it in as by fire, you know. And he had some smoke rolling off his back when he got in there. But I believe the Lord will do that. And we ought not to say, what a shame to that. More should we say, however, what a shame that we sin against God. What a shame that we do that to him.